owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. When you think about World War II, there are many moments and battles that stand out. Let's talk about three of them. The Allied invasion of Normandy on June 6, 1944, the day that signaled the beginning of the end for the Nazi menace in Europe. The Battle of the Bulge, the last major German offensive on the Western Front that caught the Allies by complete surprise. It was the largest and single bloodiest battle fought by the U.S. in World War II. And those harrowing moments when U.S. troops finally came face to face with Hitler's so-called final solution, witnessing firsthand the horrors of the Nazi concentration camps. Our guest today is the son of Russian Jewish immigrants, a family with seven children, trying to make it through the hard times of the Depression in Passaic, New Jersey. At the age of 18, he and his entire high school class were simultaneously handed their diplomas and draft notices. Irv Locker, all 5'1" of him, didn't hesitate for a moment and would go on to be a participant in three of those momentous occasions I just mentioned. We're especially fortunate to have him share his personal recollections with us today. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Staff Sergeant Irv Locker.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Irv, I'm telling you, for me, this is like you're a rock star. I mean it. I'm so thrilled to have you join us on American Warrior Radio.
Well, I'm grateful to you, too. I'm 96 years old, and I'm trying to give back because I'm so grateful to God that I came through that entire war without being wounded and severed in any relationship. So I'm grateful.
I can hardly imagine, but we're going to share your story with our listeners today, Irv. Let's go back a little bit now. Part of, I believe, in reading about you and researching your story is the strengths that you developed that helped you persevere through that horrible war came from your family. My dad was also from a large family that worked through the Great Depression. They just happened to be the descendants of German and Russian immigrants who fled to America during the First World War. But they owned a farm in the Midwest, so food was really never a problem. But nonetheless, the lessons that they learned from those hard times helped them develop character later in life. Was that similar for you, Irv?
Well, very similar, because my dad, God bless him, was a shoemaker, and I'm the baby of seven children. So when it snowed and rained in New Jersey, people would put cardboard in their shoes during the Depression because they couldn't afford a shoemaker. So he'd bring home $5 or $8 or $10 for a day for nine people, and we always had company visiting anyway, so it was very difficult. But I'm the baby of seven children, and I'm the only one of the seven that graduated high school because everybody had to go to work. And I worked after school in a gas station from 3 to 11 every single night to try to help support the family. But that's my background, and I'm just grateful to have done it and worked it through. But
Irv, something that made me smile when I was reading your story, you said that when you kids finally went to bed, Mom was sewing clothes, and when you got up, Mom was cooking breakfast. And my dad loves to tell a story about his mother actually ripped the upholstery out of one of their old Ford trucks to make clothes for them. And he said they itched like crazy, but at least we had something nice to wear on Sundays.
We had something to wear, is right. We thought she never slept because of that. You know, when we went to bed, she was sewing, and when we got up, she was making breakfast. So it's very difficult, but God bless her. She was an angel.
So you mentioned you're the first member of your family to graduate from high school, but you got your diploma and draft notice on the same day. Now, Pearl Harbor was attacked in December of 41. You graduated that following spring in 42 then, or?
Right. March 18th, we were drafted and sent down to Camp Davis. Went to Fort Dix first, and I was just training and shooting a rifle and getting a uniform and getting orders and such. Then we went to Camp Davis, North Carolina, and then we were assigned to the 116th AAA Gun Battalion. The AAA stands for anti-aircraft, anti-tank, and artillery. The guns that we were working with were 9.5 tons, The barrel of the gun was 15 feet long. I could shoot planes at 25,000 feet up into the air. And the ammunition, which is amazing, the ammunition is 3 feet tall and 45 pounds each shell. And I could fire 25 rounds a minute between my four guns.
Well, let's talk about that because, I move through, because to me, you're special. There was a lot of men like you that did their duty during the Second World War. But if I'm getting this correctly, Irv, I mean, you landed at Normandy on D-Day, you know, carried through the Battle of Bulge and basically made it all the way to Berlin. So you saw everything from the beginning of our invasion on up through the German surrender. But there's someone that I really want to mention. I did some research, made some phone calls, Irv, and you know, the word around your hometown is that Irv would not marry a girl who did not do the jitterbug. So tell us about your publicist, Bernice, I'm sorry, real quick. Over 70 years of wedded bliss, huh?
We're married 72 years, and it's an amazing thing. And for your audience, I'll crack a joke. It's 72 good years, 70 for her and 2 for me. So it's a joke, but it's a... We've had a wonderful, wonderful marriage, and we still tell each other every day how much we love each other. So.
Well, that keeps you young. Do you guys still dance?
Oh, yeah. We still dance. We still jitterbug. We live in the villages where there's dancing every single night, and then the clubs, it's a tremendous way of life here in the villages of Florida.
Irv, I'm watching some films, and particularly I could probably recite every line from the series Band of Brothers, and I know there's some of those fellows who, having survived the Battle of the Bulge, they said they never wanted to live somewhere cold ever again.
Yeah, we lived in the Battle of the Bulge, but because of the size of the guns and the velocity, we couldn't be near a building or a city. So we lived in the field, and that was the worst winter they've had. So the factory manager was below zero weather, and we lived in the field, and no houses, no nothing. We lived in the ground. So we dug a foxhole and crawled into a foxhole. I got a touch of frostbite living that way, so I'm 96 years old, and I still take medicines to prevent it. So
wow.
One of those terrible things.
Wow, yeah, okay, very good. Well, Irv, I want to talk about you go on ashore on D-Day. When we come back, we're going to take a quick break. Ladies and gentlemen, D-Day was the largest seaborne invasion in history. There were 5 designated landing sectors, Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. Now, Utah was added later in the planning because strategists recognized that we needed to secure the port of Cherbourg in order to load in more equipment and troops to support the advance. Utah was the beach that Irv and his comrades landed on. You'll hear more about that when we come back. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're joined by Irv Locker. Irv is a veteran of World War II and was involved in some of the most major actions of that war. Irv, we're talking about you and your comrades from the 116th AAA Gun Battalion landed at Utah Beach on D-Day. I've always been sort of fascinated, Irv, about the differences, and there probably weren't any. I mean, you know, the guys on the Trojan horse were probably had the jitters a little bit, you know, before they climbed out. What was it like in that landing craft, Irv, as you're headed towards that beach on D-Day?
Let me bring out an important point first that for your audience to know. The Ghost Army. Have you ever heard of the Ghost Army?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
We tried to fool the Germans with the Ghost Army. So between France and Britain, basically, they took a whole division of rubber tanks filled with air and trucks and men, and when they camouflaged it and the Germans flew over, that's where they thought we were going to invade. And they used Patton's name because they figured if Patton was there, that's where we were going to invade. So it's a very important point to bring out that was the closest point between France and England. All right, but let's get to the other point now. On June 6th, you're talking about June 6th, 160,000 of us assaulted a 50-mile stretch of Normandy, the coast of France. It was an unbelievable against the Nazi Germany, you know. There were 700 warships, 2,500 landing crafts, 326,000 men, 54,000 vehicles, and 104,000 tons of materials that they had to bring ashore. Now, we were picked with the 90-millimeter guns to come in because they knew that the minute they knew where we were going to invade, they would be bombarding and strafing and doing everything they could to keep us off the shore. It was a very, very difficult situation. I've never seen as many dead men, Americans, as I've ever seen in my life.
Now, you mentioned those guns, 9.5 tons each. The shells each weighed 45 pounds. How on earth did they, how did they get ashore?
They came ashore on what they call, they were transferred from an LST to an LCT because of the ramps. Mm-hmm. They were pulled by what they called a caterpillar, a full-track unit, because they couldn't use tires, a full-track unit like a tank, only, of course, it had carried men instead of a tank. But it was a full-track unit. That's how they came ashore.
So those units, so they're not self-propelled. Once you got to the spot, wherever it might be, that you were going to set up, how long would it take you and your crew to set that gun up and be ready to fire?
Well, we had an absolute time limit of 3 minutes to get that gun ready, to drop the outriggers and set that gun up to be fired.
And was your mission, from the way you described, Herb, your initial mission then was to set up on the beach to protect against the Luftwaffe. They didn't have much of a showing on D-Day proper. I mean, you know, our planes had taken care of a lot of that, but at which point then were you told to move inland? Because, you know, your gun was also probably the weapon of choice against those heavier German tanks.
Yeah, well, that's the big thing. Rommel, from what we were told, Rommel was going to put tanks on the beaches to keep us out, never mind the planes as well, but the tanks were going to be on the beaches. And we had the only guns that could go through the armor on a German tank like a piece of glass. That's why we went in on D-Day on that situation.
And as the staff sergeant, was it your crew? Were you kind of in charge of that crew and that particular weapon, that gun?
In charge of four of these 90-millimeter guns. So basically we had to set them up, get them in, set them up on the ground immediately, and then start, you know, be ready to fire.
So on June 6th, or what, were you sending any lead downrange? I mean, that day proper, or you're just kind of waiting for folks that didn't show up on that day? Well, I mean, on the day that you landed on June 6th, you and your crew went and, I'm assuming, set up right away. Did you actually have any encounters with the enemy that day, whether on the ground or in the air?
No.
Okay.
No. We're just there to protect the, you know, I talked about all the warships and all the landing crafts and mm-hmm. all the equipment being brought in and the men coming in. So we were there to protect that situation. So as far as firing is concerned, we didn't fire on D-Day to that point.
So how long was it before you and your crew started to move inland?
Well, immediately. I can tell you exactly within weeks that we started to move inland.
And what? So when was your first encounter with the enemy?
We came in on March, and in April we started to go against the planes. Because what they did, they didn't know we were going to land. In other words, you've seen the movies, with looking
sure.
out and everything else, you know, seeing all those 7,000 ships or what amount of, you know, to do that. But the fact remains that that's how it started out. Now, one thing I want to tell you and your audience. Somebody in our battalion headquarters kept a chronological order of every single day of the war of our battalion. So I could pick out any particular day of the war and tell you where we were and what we did and everything else.
That's amazing. So maybe you're a rock star now, Herb, and maybe you were on June 6th, maybe you weren't, but there's a rumor that, well, it's not a rumor, but the tides actually carried a lot of your landing craft about 2,000 meters away from where you were originally supposed to land. And as the story goes, Brigadier General Theodore Roosevelt, yes, relation, was yep. the ranking officer on the beach. And when he was told about it, he says, well, we'll just start the war from here.
Yes, that's and, you know, we have to tell you another thing. They call that operation Overlord. We called it Overweight. We had a 3-pound helmet on our head. We had a 27-pound pack on our back. We had a rifle. We had ammunition across our chest and our waist, and everything that we could, that everything we owned, and that's jumping into the water with that. So it's an amazing, amazing situation.
Especially for a guy that's 5'1".
Yeah, that's... The funny thing is, when I lecture, I pick a big guy in the audience, and I say, I went in on D-Day, went through the Battle of the Bulge, and didn't get wounded. And I say, really, how come? I said, I stood behind this guy. They didn't even know I was there. You know, so they get a laugh out of the audience to that point, because being 5'1" and jumping into that kind of water and working it out is unbelievable.
Now, Irv, but you, if I'm not mistaken, you also had two brothers that were drafted and served. Were they both in the European theater as well, or were they divided?
Yes. They're both in the European theater. My brother was in a tank and got wounded, and I got to see him in England.
Yeah, now, were you the first locker?
No, I was last. I was the youngest, so I was the last one drafted in the family.
Okay, so they were already... In Europe? Well, no, I guess they wouldn't have been. Were you the first one to set foot on European soil then, of the lockers, boys?
Yeah, I was the first one to make the landing on D-Day.
Wow. What, if you can, we've got just a couple minutes for the break, and I want to talk about the Battle of the Bulge, Irv, but, you know, just kind of, for those of us, yes, we see the movies, and that's a good way to communicate the message, but from someone like you who was there and who saw it and smelled it and heard it, how can you communicate that to our listeners and to the young people you talk to now?
Well, basically, the only thing that I can tell you is on the beach, they kept hollering, you're a victim if you're on the beach. Get off the beach so you can become a warrior. That's one thing. But other than that, it's a very, very difficult situation, and that's the reason that I lecture, to let the people and the young kids know what the hell it is and that freedom is not free. And the amount of men that sacrifice their lives and their limbs and everything else to make sure that freedom is free for them so that they've got to learn to appreciate it. So that's why I do this and carry this stuff around. I've got a great big Nazi flag. I've got all kinds of daggers and everything else, because one of my jobs, if a plane was shot down in my area, I would go out, make sure the plane wouldn't fly, and if the pilot wasn't dead, we captured him. But that's how we looked for maps, and that's how we looked to find out where the Germans were and, you know, where they were stationed and where they would be.
You know, Irv, the pilots in that war, well, even up to this to nowadays, you know, they keep a little tally on the side of their aircraft of how many enemy planes they shot down. Did your gun crew do the same thing? Did you put chalk marks on your cannon there?
We got credit for 97 planes shot down, the highest in the First Army. So somebody kept a record. We didn't, but don't forget, there were 4 guns to a battery, and there were 16 guns in a battalion. So the tallies were for the battalion, not the batteries. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but that's still pretty darn impressive, sir.
Oh, yeah, but it's in the book. It's in the book, and everything that I have and everything that I talk about is in writing, and I didn't write it, so it's authenticated.
We can trust you, Irv. No worries. Irv, when we come back, I'd like to talk about the Battle of the Bulge. Ladies and gentlemen, just what a precious opportunity to be talking with this veteran of World War II, Irv Locker. You can find this in over 200 interviews at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Please listen and please share. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Irv Locker, who went from the beaches of Normandy all the way to Berlin in World War II, and just so pleased to have an opportunity. He was introduced to us by Rita Cosby, and after I was able to negotiate through his gatekeeper, Bernice, we're finally able to get him on the show. Irv, we're talking about I want to talk now about the Battle of the Bulge. And help me with the time frame here. So you landed in Normandy June 6th. The Allied advance was pretty rapid. So by the time we get to the Ardennes, I mean, as I understand it, troops were exhausted, supply lines were stretched pretty thin. Was your unit already in the Ardennes when the Battle of the Bulge kicked off, or were you moved in when that happened?
No, we moved in. We moved into the Battle of the Bulge, basically.
And how was the morale of your fellow soldiers at that point?
Well, we were all worried about it and afraid and, cold. It was so cold. I must tell you, I sent my supply sergeant to our own dead men to take off the boots and coats or whatever we could, because everything had to be brought to us. People have no idea what it was without anything. Everything had to be brought to us. They had a Red Bull Express that went back to the shores, to Cherbourg, pick up supplies, to bring us food, to bring us ammunition, to bring us gasoline, to bring us, because we were moving so fast that it was a very, very difficult job to do. But that was the Red Bull Express was so very important to us. But the Germans thought that the frostbite was to their benefit, because our men were just freezing up and getting cold and crawling into a hole and wouldn't come out and different things of that type, as well.
So now, as I understand it, one of the famous scenes from Band of Brothers is they're moving into the Ardennes and they're said, well, you're going to be cut off and surrounded. And the captain says, well, that we're paratroopers. We're supposed to be cut off and surrounded. I don't think that necessarily applied to mental state of your guys. But at some point, was that supply line cut off and you all were on your own?
Yeah, absolutely. We were on our own. And that's why I said I had to send my supply sergeant to take the boots and coats and everything else that we could to help my men. So I'm Jewish. And the Jewish language, the Yiddish part of the language of Yiddish, is a derivative of German. So I couldn't speak their dialogue like I'm talking to you, but I could understand a lot of the words. So I became a procurement officer for my outfit. So I would go to the barns and go to the wherever I could and take hay and straw and everything else. And I carried a German Luger with me that was very, very educated in German. Because when I held it to their head and clicked it a few times, they said I can have anything I want. So I tried to supply our men with everything that we could while the supply lines were cut off to that point.
Boy, now I know where Bernice gets her negotiating skills. That's try to describe for us, because people, I spent a winter in South Dakota, so I know what cold is. But I had some place to go. I could put on an extra coat. I could get inside. I could, light a fire.
Yeah, but we lived in the field.
Yeah. So explain that. Because of the nature of your guns, how much clear area did you need around each gun to be able to for them to function appropriately? What kind of a field of fire did you need? Is it yards, feet?
Well, yards, not feet. It was. As far as we could possibly go, because each gun was in a separate section of the field, so so that we could cover north, south, east, and west when we were attacked, either by men, by troops, or by planes.
So were you kind of set up in a diamond formation then, or something similar, or a square? Or?
Yeah, more of a square.
And how much distance between each gun?
Well, I would say 300 feet or
okay
thereabouts, because don't forget we had still be connect. I have to tell you this: we had a miracle piece of equipment. We're talking 78 years ago. We had the radar, which could tell me the height of the plane, the speed of the plane, and how far in front of the plane I'd have to shoot in order to hit it. People have no idea what it was at that particular time in that, you know, set. So every from the radar, there were wires connected to every gun, because as we controlled it, they could tell us the height, the width, so we'd have to follow it with the barrel of our gun. So we had to be connected to the radar. But it was a miracle piece of equipment to that point of telling you how far, you know, the planes were, etc. Because people think you shoot at a plane. We have to know how far in front we'd have to shoot if they're going at 90, 100, 150 miles an hour in a plane.
What about the ground troops, though? I mean, if you're depressing the barrel to engage tanks or infantry, if you can see them, they can see you, Herb.
Yeah, but when we went for tanks, we would be on a corner. If they were told reported tanks, we would go to a corner and wait for the tanks to pass us. You understand? We would hide at a corner.
Sure.
As an example, if a road is coming down, we would hide on the corner of that road. And as the tanks pass us, we would blow them to hell.
And the other thing, too, is, I mean, I assume you were taking cover. And, again, the ground is frozen. I can't imagine what it's like to try and dig a foxhole in frozen ground. It can't be easy, but...
It can't be easy. So a lot of times we stayed on the ground with it, you know. And I had sandbags. If we were on the ground for that, we put sandbags around us. I found sandbags to go around to protect the men.
And so you guys were sleeping above ground.
Sleeping above ground. And some of the places, I must tell you this, I found some rooftops where we bombed some of the barracks, of the German barracks. I found some rooftops. So we took some of the rooftops, extended the sandbags, and put some rooftops over it to protect my men.
And is this another case where... being 5'1" was an advantage? I mean, you don't need as many sandbags to cover Irv as you do that 6'2" guy.
Unfortunately, I was one of 14 men, so believe me, you needed sandbags.
I'm flabbergasted in talking to you about this, Irv. The battle lasted just a little bit over a month. Can you describe to me I know there wasn't such a thing, but what would be sort of your typical day with for you and your fellow gun crew members?
Well, you did nothing until you got the alert to start the fire. Once you got an alert that there were planes or tanks coming, that's when it started. Otherwise, you did nothing, basically. Just do anything we could to keep warm and do anything. And we couldn't build a fire, because if we built a fire, even if you lit a cigarette, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You were afraid that the Germans would spot you. So you couldn't build a fire because we lived in a field, and that was a very difficult situation.
Were there other U.S. troops that were sort of a buffer between you and the German lines?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, one of the infantry were surrounded, and we got a call to fire to protect them so we could shoot 5 miles over to protect them. And we knocked out their trucks and knocked out their guns and everything else and saved a complete troop from annihilation.
Are those the reports that you're talking about, Herb, are those available publicly for somebody like me who might want to look at them? Or?
I don't know. I don't think so. All I know is I've got it in this book here, but I'm sure it's available publicly.
Well, I'm going to wait till the Herb Locker memoir comes out and becomes a bestseller. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, okay. One of that. Either that or come over to the house and I'll show you this book that was written by the battalion headquarters, and it gives you all the information possible with it.
By the end of that 30-month-plus battle, Herb, the casualties, at least for the U.S. forces, 89,000 casualties, 19,000 of which were killed. How was that? Did your crew fare pretty well, Herb, or did you lose some folks as well?
Well, we fared pretty well, but we did lose a lot of men. But we did very well by comparison.
And you know, again, as the story goes, you know, Patton finally broke through. The cloud cover cleared, so the planes could start operating in earnest again. And, And the paratrooper said, well, we didn't need to be rescued by Patton, but what was the feeling of you and your fellow soldiers when that was, you know, finally broke in the clear?
Well, we didn't know, basically, that they cleared it, you know, with Patton. You know, the communication was not there that everybody knew what was happening. But afterwards, it was a joyous occasion, you know. The war basically was over then, as far as we were concerned.
Well, it wasn't quite over. We still had to take Berlin. And Irv, when we come back, I want to talk about your journey further into the heartland of the Nazi Empire. And in particular, one day in the spring of 1945. Folks, you're not going to want to miss this. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with World War II veteran Irv Locker. Ladies and gentlemen, Irv and his remaining comrades, of which there are fewer and fewer, are just a national treasure for all of us. So I hope if you hear this message now or if you listen to the podcast, please share it with others, because particularly this next message that Irv is going to share with us is very important. Irv, in the spring of 1945, your unit is in a place called Gardelegen, or something like that, west of Berlin. And tell us what you guys stumbled across there.
Well, basically, we came across a camp called Gardelegen, G-A-R-D-E-L-E-G-E-N, one of the Holocaust camps. And it was unbelievable as far as I'm concerned. When we came across that camp, I'm Jewish. And to be honest with you, the first thing when I saw that camp, the first thing I did was throw up, and then I sat down and cried of man's inhumanity to man. It's unbelievable to witness such a thing. They were talking about 1,000 people put into a barn and put straw and hay on the floor and gasoline and then lit it and burned them. And if you try to get out, they machine gunned you. So they didn't want, basically, when I talked to some of the people around there, and I said, where were your eyes? What happened to, you couldn't see anything. They said to me, listen, if we opened our mouths, we'd have been in the camp. From what we could understand, the Germans were afraid that the prisoners would identify the guards. If they did that, I don't know what I would have done to those guards, to be honest with you.
I tell you, Irv, we've had a number of other World War II veterans on, one of whom was a pilot who was a prisoner of war and was liberated, and they came across some of those German guards, and they didn't do it themselves, but you know, because they were all weak and emaciated, but some of their comrades took care of, and that's all he would say. He said they went into the forest, we heard some gunshots, and they came back out, and that was done. That massacre, like you said, 1,000 prisoners burned to death, machine gunned. That, do you think, or did you get a sense, was that because they were, the Germans knew it was over, and so they were bugging out, and they just wanted to try and destroy the evidence and eliminate the witnesses, and so that's why, I mean, it's just inhumane either way.
It's inhumane, but that was basically what it was, because the guards put on suits so we wouldn't recognize them, took off the uniforms and put on clothes, you know what I mean? Because other than that, if we would have reached them. Now, I'm the only one that I know of. I've got an original map of every Holocaust camp. There were 2,400 camps. Can you even imagine it? 6 exterminating camps. If you went into an exterminating camp, you were dead. Otherwise, it was old labor, because all the German people basically were drafted into that, you know, as soldiers. And incidentally, I must tell you, your people, this is the same thing. The older men who took their allegiance to Germany, when we surrounded them, they threw up their hands, bitter, bitter, don't kill me, and they surrendered. The young kids who took their allegiance to Hitler, the Hitler youth, they fought to the death because it was like a religion to them.
And you know, it's frightening to see that we see that again now in certain parts of the world. Irv, my understanding is you actually took some photos, because even at that point you were concerned that people back on the home front wouldn't believe you, that this was actually taking place. And, you know, particularly as someone of Jewish heritage, I mean, how important it must have been to say, wait a minute, folks, now we're seeing the real evidence.
Absolutely, because so many people today will, tell me, and so many people, we have Holocaust days today here in the United States where they take and a Remembrance Day, and I'm invited to the churches, I'm invited to wherever I am at that particular time, and it's an unbelievable situation that I've got pictures of the camp, of the people, of the dead people. It's unbelievable as to what I have here.
Yeah, Irv, I'm sort of getting a sense, when you talk now about some of the places that ISIS has gone into and the fear that they put in those townsfolks. When you were talking to those Germans and they expressed to you, it's like, well, I didn't say anything because I didn't want to be the next person in the camp. I mean, could you actually see the fear in their face? Did you get a sense they're being truthful or just feeding you a line?
I think it was truthful because it was self-preservation. And basically, I had to believe them because really and truly, when they were talking to me, they were damn afraid because I had a German Luger to their head as well. So I don't think they were lying too much to me with that. So,
okay.
Like I said, it was just a matter of trying to find out why they do that. And I do this, lest we forget. And I have pictures here, and I take it every place I go, and I lecture. And it's just an amazing situation because some people still say it never happened, but they never better tell me that.
Yeah, don't get me started on that. As I understand it, the commander, at least there regionally, or maybe it was Eisenhower or whoever it was, I mean, basically they forced some of those German folks to go out there and then work on burying these remains at camps across Europe to really show them, to get them a taste of what just how horrible it was.
Absolutely, and Eisenhower was there, and he did it, and he just forced them to go out and see because they didn't believe it or wouldn't admit it.
Now, it's been 80 years, literally, since the U.S. was catapulted into the war, and many of the World War II veterans, your comrades, the ones that are still with us, still don't like to talk about the war, but you're different. And is it because you just feel it's so important that folks hear those messages and know that this was real and it's horrible and we don't ever want it to happen again?
Yes, lest we forget. Lest we forget. And people have no idea of what it is, and it's my way of giving back. I am so grateful to be alive and have both arms and both legs and a head that I'm doing this. I don't charge a penny when I go out. I carry all of this stuff with me. I carry this German flag and the daggers and the shell and everything with me to show people what it is and what we went through. But the fact remains that I'm trying very, very different, very, very hard to convince people that freedom is not free and we have to appreciate it.
Well, our audience can certainly appreciate that, Irv. You might get this, kind of appreciate this. We had a young lady who was a nurse at the Battle of the Bulge, and she also happened to be of Jewish faith. And she always, when she was treating German prisoners, she always made sure that her dog tag was hanging out so they could see that their life was being saved by a Jewish woman. And I think she got by the way, she carried brass knuckles in her coat just in case, though. But she got a chuckle that. Coming home, you took advantage of the GI Bill. You've been very successful. We've got about 2 minutes left, but, being invited to the State of the Union and being recognized by the president is pretty exciting stuff. But tell us about the encounter you had with a French child in Normandy on the 75th anniversary of D-Day and their T-shirt.
All the children were wearing T-shirts. I am a child of freedom, mercy, dear veteran. And I said to the teacher, my God, I got to buy one of those shirts to take home. I was awarded the French Legion of Honor. They had all heard about it, but nobody had seen it. And I was wearing that medal in addition to the other one, but that medal. So everybody was anxious to take pictures of me and be with me, etc. So this child came over to me and said to me, you can't buy this. He took it right off his back and gave it to me, and I have it here and in my display, and I take it all over because our kids know nothing at all about this.
It makes me shake my head and saddens me that the French children remember that and know the power of it, and ours don't.
Well, they went through it, and ours didn't.
Yeah.
That's the big difference. They lived in the cellars. They lived in the ground. They lived any place they could, you know, to that point because of the bombing and because of all the killing and everything else and the Nazi occupation of it. You know, that was to them the worst thing at all.
Herb, we're running out of time, and it's been we'll have to have you back on again sometime soon. But what you know, you and your story is the reason that we do what we do to communicate these messages. Anything you want to leave with our listeners as we roll up the show today?
Oh, the only thing that I talk about is freedom is not free, and we just have to thank all the veterans that gave their life and their limbs so that they could be free.
Do you interact at all with some of the veterans coming back from the current wars?
No, okay. Not at all. But I lecture here, and I'm called all over the place to lecture and talk about these different things and show my different objects that I brought back.
So, Herb, you're 96 years young. You're still going strong. What's next for Herb and Bernice? We gonna see a major motion picture, or maybe on Dancing with the Stars or something?
We still go dancing. We still go tell jokes, and we still do everything to stay alive and well and laugh and appreciate life, basically.
There's the strong message. Herb Locker, thank you, and thanks to Bernice for joining us here on American Warrior Radio, and you stay strong and take care, sir.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. You can find this podcast and over 250 others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. Please find us. Our podcasts are anywhere that you podcast. We're on Pandora. We're on Stitcher, Deezer, Google, Apple, Amazon. Please listen to these stories and share them. If you want to support us, go to Patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. You can kick a little money into the pot to keep these messages strong. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures will remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.